This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello and welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, a musically talented family keeps the spirit of one of their own alive thanks to a small homemade studio right above Mama's Kitchen. Also, Cape Breton Liberal MPs Jaime Batiste and Mike Kellaway are back on the show after winning this month's federal election. These stories are coming up on the Coast. When it comes to the recent federal election, as they say, it's out with the old and in with a new version of the old. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's Liberals did not get their majority government after a 36-day campaign, the minimum length of time allowed for a federal election in Canada. After the votes were counted, the Liberals returned to Ottawa, again with a minority government, and the Liberal incumbents from the campaign trail for the two local ridings in Cape Breton are back in familiar territory. Here's Dialogue's Dave DeVoe with Sydney Victoria MP Jaime Batiste.
Okay, so first off, Jaime, congratulations on the win. I imagine you're feeling pretty good right about now.
Yeah, feeling very relieved, feeling very happy. We ran a good campaign and put a lot of hard work, knocked on a lot of doors, made a lot of calls, and I thought our team did an excellent job. And yeah, I'm just very relieved and honored to be able to continue serving.
So there's a number of issues, of course, that you're dealing with. I want to start perhaps with the biggest one, which is health care. It was a big issue in the provincial and in the federal campaign. And as you know, Premier Houston is going to be, well, he's promised a lot of health care spending at the provincial level, and he says he's going to do it anyway, but he's asking the feds for some money as well. He's going to be talking to Mr. Trudeau. As a representative of you know, from this part of the country, what would you like to see the federal government put on the table to support healthcare spending at the provincial level?
Well, what we were talking about in the platform was $9 billion to the healthcare system and transfers. We all know that it's a provincial jurisdiction, but we're going to try to be able to recruit 7,500 more doctors and nurses. But of course, first and foremost, we have to win the fight with COVID all across Canada. We can't keep going backwards in terms of the COVID waves and expect that people want to go into the healthcare system. But we also have to start being realistic and starting to figure out how are we going to get more doctors? How are we going to do this? This is something that, of course, is provincial jurisdiction, but I think we need to start looking at different options out there. Some of the things that I've been hearing are about physician's assistants, which only take 2 years to get people through, and it's not something in Nova Scotia yet, but I hope that they begin looking at this, because I did knock on a door with a physician's assistant and said, there's hundreds of physician's assistants across Canada that are unable to work, that want to work in hospitals and things like that. We just need to change the rules a little bit provincially and figure out how we can accommodate and create more people who can do that.
What about the concern over building more home care beds? Because as we all know, that issue is really tied into the wait times in healthcare, and Premier Houston is looking for, he says he's going to spend money to build new beds, but he's probably going to be asking for help from Ottawa on that. Is that something you would support as well?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to support what's in the platform. That was $6 billion towards long-term care homes, and that's $6 billion is a substantial number, so I know the Prime Minister's it's on his radar and he's taking it seriously, and that was something we talked to about at the doors, but the other part was also about moving from $15 a minimum wage to $25 a minimum wage for those people working in long-term care facilities.
Now, healthcare has a lot of moving parts, as I'm sure you know. Just a couple more things. One thing that you have mentioned a little bit is pharmacare. There was the Hoskins group did their report on that, and there's talk about taking steps to set it up. But as an MP, what kind of progress would you want or expect to see on the pharmacare issue?
Well, we saw in PEI one deal negotiated. I'm hoping that we can get there with Nova Scotia as well. You know, this is something that was talked about at the Liberal Convention. It was one of the most the idea that we all support. I support pharmacare for people, especially those who are the most vulnerable, seniors, people with disabilities. I want to be able to be sure that people, you know, aren't having to choose between their groceries and their medicine. This is something that we need to look at, and you know, I want to see how it works out in PEI, and if it works, and see if we can bring that to other provinces across Canada, especially Nova Scotia.
Okay. Now, moving on to another issue that was really big in the campaign is the environment. I'm sure you're familiar with the latest IPCC report. They're really sounding alarm bells there. Given those strong alarm bells, should we be confident that the government is doing enough now? Because some scientists are saying much, much more has to be done than any government is willing to do. So how confident are you that the goal of reducing emissions, that your 2050 emission goal is going to be enough?
I think we have ambitious plans. I think we have we're moving in the right direction. I'm concerned with progress that we're making across the globe in terms of the environment. I think we need to start doing more. And I think that's why I introduced my environmental labeling private members motion in the House that looked at making sure that anything that we consume gets an environmental grade. Because I think informed consumers, and if Canadians were informed about the impact of the environment, whether it's water usage, waste usage, carbon footprint, if Canadians were aware of what they were consuming and its impact on the environment, they'd make better decisions. If they make better decisions, industry will make better decisions. If industry makes better decisions, you know, government will help make better decisions. And I think that, you know, we all have to realize we all have a part to play in doing more for our environment. And it's not just something that you look at government. It has to be businesses. It has to be individuals. And it has to be all of us across the globe in this effort, because really I didn't hear it enough at the doors. I wish I heard it more, because it was one of the reasons I got into this, is because I saw a need and an urgency that was being sounded by you know, the United Nations and environmentalists across Canada. And I, you know, as someone who studied Indigenous philosophy, it was one of something that is very important to us as Mi'kmaq. You know, you're taught at a very young age, Nitigum, you live within balance within your ecosystem. You're not above your ecology. You're connected to it. Whatever we do to our environment, we're doing to ourselves. And I think that that's probably the most important thing that we should be focusing on in the near future, is because how do we solve this is the greatest threat to our existence, and it's going to take a whole of Canada approach.
Now, we're talking about the environment at a time when economic development is on a lot of people's minds, especially in economically disparaged places like Cape Breton. Can you say a little bit about how you would support and how your party would support, you know, effective economic development here while keeping the climate issue in mind?
Well, I think Joe Biden said it best. You know, when he thought of green energy and our transition moving forward, that only one thing came to his mind: jobs. And I think jobs will be created. One of the things I know we're talking about in Nova Scotia caucus is the Atlantic Loop, taking the energy that hydro energy from Quebec and distributing it across the Atlantic to reduce our impact on coal and things like that. And that's going to create jobs. It's going to create infrastructure. And just green energy is going to take a transition, but it's going to create jobs, and that's what's going to happen. But it's a transition that we have to do. It's something that we have to be aware of, and it's something that we have to do to make sure that the survival of humanity.
So, what kind of opportunities do you see on the horizon for green jobs in Cape Breton that government could play a role in kickstarting and promoting?
And I think that's all within the transition to green energy. I think that's, if you want me to be specific, I can't at this point talk about certain projects to the media that I'm not allowed to talk about, but there are important things going forward, and there's important environmental infrastructure that was committed in the budget that we passed in June that we don't have to, that we don't have to go back to the House and negotiate for. These are things that are already passed in the budget, and we had a good plan moving forward, and now it's about implementing that plan.
Okay, so you're confident some good projects are coming forward for the island?
I am.
Okay. I want to move on to another issue. In a number of ways, touches on your experience and work. Reconciliation, obviously, was a big issue in the election. And we also saw that the federal fisheries minister, Bernadette Jordan, lost her seat in an area where there was tensions over the moderate livelihood fishery. I wonder if you could just say a little bit about the work that you did on the fisheries committee and how you think that work might contribute to lessening tensions and furthering reconciliation?
Well, I think the biggest thing that people need to understand, I guess, is that, you know, you have to involve all parties and you have to listen. And I think that was the biggest thing that I did during the whole discussion around moderate livelihood. You know, I warned a caucus months before it could happen that if we had a bad fishing season, that this could escalate. And it did. And because of COVID and But one of the things that we need to realize as well is that there's ability for us to work collaboratively to find solutions. And, you know, we've got two different approaches that are, you know, from fisheries associations and to Mi'kmaq leaders. And, you know, sometimes you've got to meet in the middle somewhere to create progress. And I think that myself and the Senators Christmas and Senator Francis put ideas on the table for us to move forward on. We still believe in those ideas. And if you want to look at what we thought was the Atlantic First Nations Fisheries Authority, that could be something that is modeled after what we've done with taking control of education or taking control over water. These are all things that the best examples of how Indigenous groups have moved forward is doing so together, collaboratively, and they always result in the best approaches. And I think that's a thing that our government is moving forward on with reconciliations, making sure that all of our approaches are co-developed with the Mi'kmaq communities or within the First Nations communities in Canada or within the Indigenous communities in Canada. It's a big part of that co-development. And I don't think enough people talk about the United Nations Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People Act that we passed, Bill C-15, and that we're moving forward on implementation of those rights over the next 2 years with a substantial budget that was already approved. And I'm going to be glad to be part of that work moving forward.
Here's Dave again behind the mic, this time with Caper and Canso MP Mike Calloway.
So Mike, I'll just start by congratulations, and I wanted to sort of pose the first question to you on the topic of healthcare, like I did with your colleague, Mr. Batiste, and I want to ask, given that healthcare is such a big issue in the past federal and provincial elections, and given that the provincial government is promising to spend some more on healthcare, and they're going to be asking Ottawa for some help. Just wondering what you, as a representative of this region and chair of the Atlantic Caucus, I guess, would like to see Ottawa put on the table if Mr. Houston asks for some help.
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, thanks for having me, Dave. It's great to be on the show. So I would look at it this way, is that we had a pretty strong platform that was focused on healthcare, looking at 7,500 new healthcare professionals, doctors, nurse practitioners, social workers. I would like for us to get to work immediately on that, working with the province of Nova Scotia on very much that item. That would be number one. Number two is providing some significant investments as well to assist doctors to come to rural Canada, which our riding is rural Canada, Cape Breton, Canso. That meaning that doctors in particular will need assistance, financial assistance in setting up practices. I think the federal government can play a meaningful and impactful role there with the province. The Tim Houston government has talked about the importance, and in fact, they've created a specific role and a specific minister, Brian Comer, as a minister that's focusing on mental health. In our platform, we want to make a specific investment, transfer money specifically for mental health care. So that is to look at hiring mental health care workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, people at the grassroots level.
Is that going to be mental health care money in addition to the health money that would have been sent, or is that taken out of the money that's already been sent?
No, that's a great question. So that would be money that would be separate from the usual monies that go, the transfer monies that go from the federal to the provincial. And that would be a specific line item, Dave. And it's a great question because a lot of times the monies will be somewhat unconditional. And I think we need to find common ground in terms of lining up specific outcomes with respect to that money. I think a really good sandbox of collaboration between the new provincial government, who wants to focus specifically and rightly so on healthcare, and quite frankly, a federal government that wants to do the same thing.
I'm wondering if, given the large amount or the large proportion of older people we have in the province, if it might not be appropriate for the Atlantic Caucus to maybe push for a little more federal money for healthcare, because there are still those who are arguing that the money we're getting is not really addressing the disproportionate number of seniors we have. Can the Atlantic Caucus do anything on that, or do you think that we are getting, you know, money that does recognize that disproportion?
Well, I think the increase in transfers have happened even during my time, but the fact of the matter is that, you know, the price of everything in society has gone up. And so can the Atlantic Caucus play a role in advocating? I've seen it firsthand in my 2 years and in my last 6 or 7 months, maybe 6 months of being Atlantic Caucus chair. I mean, our caucus is actually well known within government to be a very collaborative, cohesive, and effective caucus because we work together. So when it comes to making increases in healthcare, you know, the platform that has mental health is a separate line item in terms of a transfer fund. To a large degree, that came from Atlantic Canada in terms of our priorities. So we can have a monumental impact within government, the Atlantic Caucus can, and I've seen it. I've seen it with the Fisherman's Benefit. I've seen it with the community revitalization funds that are from coast to coast to coast. That emanated from Atlantic Caucus.
So could that that same kind of action result in you guys maybe asking for a little more money for health care?
Why not? Why not? I mean, it is a huge priority for us in Atlantic Canada. It is a huge priority for me. Will I be pushing for increased investment? Yes. But we also, and this is me speaking as an MP, what I'd also like to see is monies that are allocated for specific purposes, not necessarily just a lump sum of money with no outcomes attached to it per se. I'd like to see, you know, like the mental health monies, transfers that have a specific alignment to a specific program, a specific outcome. And so I'd like to think that there's an opportunity there to find common ground on that. The responsibility of the administration of healthcare is provincial. The funding of it is predominantly federal. So perhaps we can look at a slightly nuanced way to get to the same outcomes, and that's what I'll be pushing for. But you better believe it. My experience on the healthcare file before I was elected was working in community to work with like-minded people to attract doctors and other healthcare professionals. And the problems with healthcare are many. It's not just one particular thing. It goes from payment to, you know, personal care workers, to recruitment of doctors, to retention of doctors, to so many more things. So we're going to, you know, I think if we're going to achieve the shared outcomes, which is shared outcomes that are the same for the people that live here, provincial government, federal government, we have to kind of look at what do we want to achieve with the funding that we're going to go after. And I think we're at that moment in time where I think we can all work on that together. I'm not suggesting that there won't be challenges, but the stakes are too high.
I think the phrase high stakes provides a good segue into the next topic I wanted to bring up, which is environment and climate change. Uh-huh. Stakes pretty high there. And, of course, you guys are promising to you're promising certain greenhouse gas reduction targets. There are scientists and other critics who say it's not enough. What do you see happening on the climate front? And I guess in Cape Breton-Canso, specifically, what opportunities are there for us as that whole transformation takes place?
Well, again, you know, I'm an MP and I represent a party that believes that climate change is here. So I look at, there are two opportunities, and I'm just focusing on two. There are many more. But there are two opportunities within Cape Breton Council that we can capitalize, I believe, on the green economy. And that's the Forsuren Center at Cape Breton University, where they've attracted, you know, 10 small companies, to work with the Forsuren Center on bioenergy. And I think we can continue to grow that, grow the number of companies, grow the infrastructure the Forsuren Center needs to attract new companies and grow existing ones within the riding. The second area that I think is one that is really worth exploring, and I know it is being explored, is around offshore windmills. And given our environment and our propensity for wind offshore, that's something that I think is something that we can certainly do a deeper dive on. And then just looking at things, Dave, that every citizen can do and get some money to be able to do it, like making, you know, sound retrofits, environmental retrofits to your own home and receiving a grant to do so.
Now, before I let you go, Mike, I should bring up another important issue that I'm almost positive you've heard on the doorstep, two interrelated issues, actually, and that's the economy and poverty. You know, despite all of the talk from the politicians, we still have really high rate of poverty here in the CBRM, and, you know, there's a lot of perhaps justifiable malaise about the state of our economy and the poverty levels. So what can your party do, not, you know, over the next few years, but what concrete steps can you take in the near term to make some change economically into poverty rates?
Well, I think the cycles of poverty are many. So yes, it is economic development and jobs, but it's also things such as access to affordable daycare. And when we talked about affordable daycare in our platform and working with the province of Nova Scotia, yes, that is first and foremost, you know, children's education, but it's also enabling people that are staying home because they can't afford daycare to get back into the workforce. And we do have pockets within Cape Breton that have seen you know, labor decline or skill shortage. So there are opportunities. We need, I always believe that government can play a fundamental role in economic development, but we need to get behind those small businesses like Jill McPherson with the Island Folk and Island Cider. We need to get behind newcomers who are coming here who want to set up shop, and we need to expand the island, the anti-immigration pilot to enable municipalities to be nominees of that city soap, because if you look at it, municipalities know, I think, the greatest where those areas of opportunity are and where those needs are. So we need to invest more into the Atlantic Immigration Pilot. We need to ensure that we make the $10 a day daycare happen. We need to make investments with green companies that want to come to Cape Breton. We need to encourage more people to come here to work remotely, which means we need to improve our game in terms of broadband and cell phone coverage, which we're doing. So there's not one particular way. I wish I could say to your viewers, or listeners rather, that there is one thing that will change everything overnight. But I do think in many cases we are seeing movement on that, but it's not quick enough and people are hurting. So I'd like to actually see us over time, you know, look at the Canada Child Benefit. That's taken about 6,000 people, young people, in our riding out of poverty, but we need to do more there. So I look at it this way, David. It's a looking at what measures we have to help people that are direct monies into people's pocket, but also what support can we be on the side, supporting local businesses, entrepreneurs, daycare, and other elements related to economic development. So there's much work to do. This has been my area of where I've worked in terms of economic and community development. I can tell you there's a lot of things happening that tend not to get discussed and that are positive, But there's a lot of things that are happening that we need to stem the tide. Investment is one way, but also an engaged MP that knows the local business community, knows the local not-for-profit community, and that isn't just there to cut a ribbon, but is there to be in the foxhole as the idea emerges. And that's what I'm looking forward to going forward.
Now, we've been talking about economic development in Cape Breton for a long, long time, and we've been talking about trying to attract investment for a long, long time. But, you know, the poverty rate keeps going up. The economy, you know, by most measures, I think people would agree, is getting worse. And there's been some cynical suggestion, I've even heard some politicians say it, that the job of politicians like you is to basically to manage the decline of this place rather than stem the tide. But do you think that you can actually aspire to, you know, stem the tide rather than just manage the decline of this place? Is there something better that can really be?
Because
I think you can understand the cynicism of some people out there given the conditions, though, right?
I refuse to believe that. At least from my perspective, you sit by and watch decline happening without a fight. But it's how you fight. Are you a smart fighter, or are you a person that just wants to throw haymakers and make noise?
Paul Dunn of North Sydney was a well-known local musician known for playing with the Rockin' Saints and Matt Minglewood, just to name a few of the high-profile local talents. Paul's busy career on the local scene did leave some time for him to write his own music. He passed away a few years ago while working on an album. That album was incomplete until his family decided to finish it. On Dialogue this week, we'll hear from his brother Kim and his son Adrian. Here's Kim talking about his brother's roots in music.
He and his other two friends, Tony Quinn and Neil Chambers, were a very creative trio, and they did things. They recorded some of their music. They were writing their own tunes, and it was great tunes. And they did some recordings at CBC. Some of those things are lying around somewhere, and you can actually hear them. He moved on into doing some band work, Rockin' Saints, early bands like the Children of Og, the Big Moth, cool names, but great bands. They, you know, a lot of the members in those bands, Donnie Hand, for example, went on to work professionally in the music industry with Minglewood and people like that. You know, always good musicians and great bands. Paul eventually, I remember Earthbound was a local band that came out of a band called Moondog, and that was Billy Drake and Ian Anker and Cody LaValle and drums and all these guys, you know, just a great band, and Owen Hand on bass. And so from there, Paul also went to Mount Allison and studied music up there. He was classically trained as well. I mean, He studied music up there, and of course that took his playing abilities even further. He eventually moved home from there, and that was when he kind of got back into playing in the local scene with Earthbound, I believe, and that outfit. And then eventually the call came down from Minglewood, and he played with Minglewood from the second album, when they signed a big RCA deal, and the Can't You See album, and three or four albums after that. And then after Minglewood, he kind of hung it up and settled down, and he didn't play any more live music.
So, Kim, while he was developing his craft that led him to finding himself in the company of, a high-profile name like Matt Minglewood, what was it about Paul's music that garnered that attention for some of these local stars that wanted to play with him?
Well, I mean, I guess first and foremost was his talent. Like, you know, know, he was, I mean, he was a monster player. I mean, he was a great player, you know, and just an amazing player, you know. And as a player, I can recall what it was like to just be amazed at what he could do. I don't know if all of those bands were focusing on original music at the time. Like, you know, some of them were, like I said, but not all of them were. So, you know, some of them were just kind of cover bands and local bands playing the bars kind of thing. I remember Matt seeking out Paul, because of all of the things that he could do. He wanted somebody who could write, and he was looking for somebody who could really play. And as it turned out, he ended up writing a few songs with Matt. He ended up on a couple of albums. But yeah, I would think initially it was just his ability. It was just his talent. I don't know, you know.
Adrian, what was it like playing music with your father? And when you write or play music now, can you feel his influence or his style when you're singing or strumming the guitar or playing the bass?
Well, I mean, it was just a total honor to work with him on the project. Some of the most fond memories I have in the past several years of my life are of, you know, producing and working on this album with him in the bedroom studio there. I think I learned a lot, you know. Like, he was such a good producer and he had such a great pop sensibility that it was like just kind of listening to him and to his ideas and just kind of figuring out the way that he sort of thought about music and about guitar parts and arrangements and stuff. Like, I learned a lot just as a musician. And I kind of have a similar pop sensibility, I guess. We kind of have similar kind of writing styles. So, I don't know. I can hear some similarities, I guess. But ultimately, yeah, it's just, I guess I'm just a chip off the old block, really.
Hmm. You mentioned a studio there, and a very compelling part of Paul's story is that he seemed like a very grounded person and wanted to share his message that sometimes the simple things in life are often set aside. And can you talk about how he wanted to express that through his music, Kim, if you don't mind? He took a very homegrown approach to making an album. What can you tell us about Mama's Kitchen, and why was this a labor of love for him?
Well, it certainly was. It was nothing but a labor of love. I mean, he wasn't involved in playing music like live or in the business or anything anymore. He wasn't making his living by it, and quite a bit of time had passed since those days. But he kept writing and he was teaching some piano for a while at home. But you know, he had these songs kicking around and he wanted to do something with them, but he set up a studio upstairs in his bedroom, basically, and started picking away at it. And his vision was always to utilize the family and the talent that everybody had. And so that was the extent of the goal and the vision. And so, you know, in fact, I'm pretty sure he... the last thing he was thinking of was the idea of what we're doing right now, you know, releasing it and trying to get the profile up on it and growing it and interviewing it and talking about it and spreading it around. That wasn't his primary goal at all, you know. Is that about right, Adrian, would you think?
I don't recall talking to him about, like, what comes afterwards, but I mean, I can only assume he wanted to just kind of get it out there. I think it was more important for him to just sort of finish it, really, just do it.
Yeah,
he had these songs, some of these songs are probably older than I am, so I think it's just a process, something that he really wanted to accomplish. And he worked really hard on it for as long as he could, and I'm just glad we could finally finish it.
Unfortunately, Paul passed away a few years ago, but his music living on through his family and through this album. You decided to finish this work, which has been described as a family album set to music. Can you talk about this idea, and how did you feel? Did you feel a closeness to Paul as you were recording it, and did you feel him there in spirit in the studio with you guys?
Yeah. Do you want me to go first there, Adrian, or... I know Adrian felt extremely close to him, but
of course, like, how could you really, what could bring a son closer to his father than like creating this this project that's just so rooted in family and love. I think there was a definite closeness through the entire process, really. And I think the beautiful thing about it is that not only did everyone kind of sort of gravitate towards Paul brought the family closer together, but the family became closer with each other, you know, during the whole process of recording, and he was in the hospital.
Yeah. Man, if there's one thing I learned from the whole thing is that I'm pretty safe to say we all will have each other's back no matter what. That much is true, and that was always true, but even more evident now. And me, speaking from an observer, Adrian, I know from experience that sometimes you do a project, and some stand out more than others, and they, to the point where they can shape you and stay with you for years and stuff. And I saw that happening to you, man. I mean, like, your guitar work is phenomenal. I mean, really, the guitar work on the album is phenomenal. But I always... And I know you worked really closely with Paul doing that. That's got to be a really good feeling, you know? I just saw you kind of blossom as a player through this whole thing. That's pretty special, man. When you get to see that happening before your eyes, it's a special thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I put so much of myself into this, and, it's something... That's definitely, like you said, it definitely shapes a person, and it's definitely grown, and just something that everyone can be proud of, you know. Like,
for sure.
I don't think I've really contributed as much to any other musical project as I have to this one, and I'm proud of the whole thing.
Totally, man. And you know what? Like, I mean, there were lots of reasons, you know, family coming together, all that stuff in the home, and all that stuff. But that's a sign of an amazing producer too, right? I mean, that's essentially what they do, bring the best out in people. And man, Paul could do that. And not only musically, but just in any way, right? I mean, brought the best out in a person in every way, in every aspect. And sincerely, you know, I mean, I really mean that. And pretty special.
He was so easy to work with too. It was like, I mean, obviously he had his ideas, of course, but he was just completely open to any ideas that anybody else ever had.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, coming from a, you know, you're playing. I just wanted to make my old man proud, you know. So it was like kind of that little bit of pressure kind of ups your game a little bit, you know.
It was a thrill for me too, though. You know, I got to say, like. Because I idolized Paul. He was my hero, man. And he taught me how to play. I looked up to him my whole life, ever since I started playing and everything. But, you know, now I'm getting on, and I've been doing it for a long time, and I've experienced a lot studio-wise and whatever. But we never really worked together, right? Except for writing a couple of songs along the way. But so this, for me, too, was a really amazing experience, because it was just finally a chance to really kind of get creative together and put the put the pieces together. And I mean what I did compared to what he did was a small part, but there was an ease to it, and there was a peacefulness to it, you know. Really easy, like Adrian said, super easy to work with, and respectful, and just it was just a really, really sweet process.
You know, it's interesting hearing you guys speak like that. It would make someone, a music fan, think of something. At the time, it was a breakthrough video, and it was Hank Williams Jr. in a video with his father, Hank Williams, and I think the song was A Tear in My Beer, but it was so much ahead of its time where they actually got to work together like that. And just what you were saying there, Kim, it kind of made me think of that, and it must be hard to put into words, really.
Yeah, it definitely is, you know, because... upon reflection, I suppose it will be easier with time. I'm still reflecting upon it, but when it's happening, it's just happening. You know, it's not. And the reason why it works is because it isn't contrived, and you're not thinking about it. But again, I saw that in you, Adrian, and I'm not. You know, here I am, like just blowing smoke. But it needs to be said. And I've done a few interviews, as you did, Adrian, and we both have so far. And I never had the chance to say it, but and all the work you've done so far, and picking up the torch, you know, to finish it, and everything, just can't be overstated. The amount of heart and soul you put into this, I know everybody did, but I think you get to wear the C and the sweater for this one. You get the Panasonic play of the game, man.
Yeah, that's for sure.
For good fun, yeah.
Adrian, it's a great album. One of my favorites on it is Carved in Stone, and I just want to play a bit of it right here.
I am with you. It's your darkest hour.
Kim, you're on lead vocals here, and Adrian, you're playing the guitar, but the album credits show that many members of the family are involved here. What is it about this song? Is there something meaningful behind the song title and about your dad's dedication to his family? Is there a relationship between that title, Carved in Stone, and what it meant to him to have that permanent connection in the family unit?
I think so. I mean, that song, not like... today, it's just, without question, the heaviest song lyrically. At the time, it was like, the lyrics are, you are not alone, I am with you. And it's, you know, now that takes on such a whole new meaning. So I think there is a permanent connection now, because just the way that that song kind of came together, just the entire family just sort of swooped into the studio to finish the song for Dad while he was on his deathbed, and just the connection that the family had with each other and with Paul, now it is carved in stone. You know, that's a memory. Being in the studio there a few weeks before Christmas, a few weeks before he passed, is definitely a memory that's etched in all of our minds. So I think it's become a very fitting title.
Yeah, nicely said, profound. And you know, it was an 11th hour song, like Adrian said. He was in the hospital, but like, we didn't even know about it until he mentioned it. He said something to the effect of, you know, it's a drag that this song didn't get on the CD. And we were like, what song? And so it was, and then when we realized, you know, that this great tune was out there, we just kind of bolted into action. We immediately started producing it. But so knowing, I mean, it was that it was obviously very special and important to him. I think the song was a statement. I think he wanted to leave. I think it was a message that he wanted to leave. Certainly for you, Adrian, and Evan, your brother, and for all I know, maybe the whole family. I don't know, but I was thinking about that yesterday, it's a powerful tone, we're really proud of the production, how that turned out. You know, great tone.
It must be remarkable to be able to be in a studio, a homemade studio like that, with your family. The level of comfort there, having that level of comfort, knowing the people so well that you're making the music with, does that change in the quality of music?
You know, I don't know. I'm obviously biased with, you know, because it's my family as well. But it's like, I feel like you can just hear the actual family, like the concept of family on the album. Like, everybody's voices blend so well, and they all sound like one unit. And yeah, I don't know. I just felt like the recording of it was probably the easiest part. It was just such a breeze, you know, working with Dad, mainly with Dad, for sure.
Yeah. There's the sound of the family unit, which is you know, no secret to anybody. You know, there's just a sound with a family that you can't get otherwise, you know. But the, again, you know, the ease that everything went down, I think that was Paul, having the production skills and having the vision and knowing the direction, you know. Not a real director, not you know, producer slash director, that those are all intangibles. That I know what it's like to go into a studio and do something and kind of mail it in. You know, I know what it's like. You mean, whether you're not up for it that day, or you're not into the tune, or you still do your best and you still do an adequate job, but it's just not the heart or maybe or the soul or all, you know, always. But I think for this year, there was always the heart and the soul, you know. And so that's the secret sauce.
Sure thing. The CD release is coming up soon with a special performance. What can you tell our listeners about that, please? What do we need to know about the CD release party coming up?
For one thing, like I guess technically the CD is already released, isn't it? Because we're selling it, and it's on. You know, we're pushing it on social media and stuff. So it's more of a celebration, and I'm kind of glad that it's been circulating for a few weeks now, because I think it's just heightening people's kind of excitement to come out. Not just hear the tunes live, but hey, see the Dunn family. that's all good stuff, you know. And some friends will be joining us, and it's so I think it's going to be a magical night. It really is. I think it's going to be a good night of music, and there's going to be people in there in the audience that will be very closely associated and connected with the family, and you know, a lot of friends, a lot of good friends, and relatives and family. You know, so yeah, what more could you ask for?
And where can people get the tickets? Where can they find out the details of where and when?
Well, I guess the best thing to do is to call the Amira Center in North Sydney. That's where the event is going to be held on the Saturday night of Thanksgiving weekend. You can call, or if you know any of the family members, you could always get one through us, you know. But the best thing to do really is to just kind of call the Amira Center. They're looking after the bulk of the tickets, and they will put your name on a waiting list until we hear about the restrictions are, you know. So that's the best thing to do.
Well, Adrian and Kim, I want to thank you again for sharing this amazing story with us, and best of luck on the album release. We're going to wrap up with the title track for the album, Mama's Kitchen. And once again, best of luck. And if anyone wants to find out information about the CD release party, get in touch with the Amira Center.
Yeah, and want to thank you, Bill, for letting us come on and do this.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Two nose guitars and make another pot of tea. Call a crowd and we get loud and have a party. And I loved it in Mama's kitchen. She was always there.
That's all for Dialogue this week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill McCush.
Catch Dialogue 3 times weekly, Sundays at noon, Tuesday and Thursday at 10 p.m. Dialogue is a production of the Coast 89.7 News. For story suggestions, contact 902-849-9303 or email news@coastalradio.ca. For past episodes of Dialogue, check out our Dialogue podcast, available now online at coastalradio.ca.